The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show. I'm your host, Charles Christian, and thank you very much for tuning in again. This week we are talking demonology with Nathaniel Gillis. Nathaniel is an author, researcher and demonologist. After growing up in a haunted house, he has sought to redefine the nature of haunting phenomena. His research in the field of demonology is considered by many to be groundbreaking. So let's get straight on with the interview. So, Nathaniel, good to speak to you.
Thank you, sir. I'm so glad to be here with everyone.
Right. Where would we like to start? Because I'm seeing in your bio, you say you grew up in a haunted house.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We can start there if you'd like.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I moved into a house at the age of 8 years old that was pretty much incredibly haunted. I mean, as an 8-year-old kid, it's a new house, it's a new environment, a new town. But it started when my family was looking at buying it. We went to the open house and my father was, just kind of laying out the land and saying, this is where we're going to have this, table, this couch. And he led me by the hand and brought me to a room. And he said, now, Nathaniel, he said, if we do end up purchasing this home, this would in fact be your room. And I vividly remember a stench in that space. It was profuse. It was rancid. It smelled like decomposing or rotting organic matter.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt very dark and the air was thick. And I knew that this is one of the most interesting things about it, especially this research, is that early on, I knew that I was feeling something.
Yeah.
But I had no concept of what it was.
And nobody else noticed, did it? Because, I mean, when you move into new houses, if they've been empty or whatever, there's often smells there, but nobody else in your family got, oh, this is a bit ripe.
Yeah. No, sir. Well, not at that time. I remember like 10 years later, once we had left the house, my father pulled me aside and said, you remember all that stuff you were telling me about going on? I said, yeah. He goes, I believed you. Right.
Gee, thanks, Dad, I guess.
Yeah, right. A decade later, really? He experienced some things, and he told me that early on that he did believe that someone had died in that house. And to me, it was quite obvious. But that's just because of the manifestations that would go on. But that's originally how it started. And that between the ages of 8 and 16, I mean, my God, I would have the same nightmare for weeks on end. It was always in black and white. And as a young, very young 8-year-old boy, I had no concept of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And, I didn't even mean suicide. What's suicide? I had no concept of anything like that. However, the dreams that I would suffer from would include, it was the same dream, same narrative. It was always in black and white. And it consisted of me walking up to a shelter where people would have like a family reunion at a park. And I saw these two young guys sitting on a picnic table. One has a needle in his arm and the other one notices me coming and turns to look at me, grins, puts a gun in his mouth, pulls a trigger. And then it was the same way every night. I would wake up shivering. And there would be a dark, ominous, malevolent presence in the room.
Yeah. Did you subsequently discover anything about the history of the property?
I have not. I went back about 2 years ago, and the home itself was empty. And I talked to some of the neighbors that I'm still very good friends with, and they said that since we had left, that the house has not been able to hold people, tenants rather, for longer than 5 or 6 months, mm-hmm. which is
right.
categorically classic, you know, for a haunting.
Yes.
It happens all the time. Yeah. So, but that's where my experience with the paranormal began. It did follow me to different houses, and but that's, you know, that was my introduction into this field.
And from there, because I'm guessing you can now find online courses on demonology, but I'm guessing during your school and college days, that wasn't the option. How did you?
It wasn't, yeah. What, not a menu? Not at all.
Yeah. It's one thing to have an interest. How did it then develop into a career?
I grew up in the Christian tradition. So at the age of 12, my local church was grooming me to be in the ministry. And the particular religious institution I was a part of was Pentecostalism.
Right.
And so, you know, they're huge in the deliverance ministry. And not to say that I valued a lot of what they taught or even agreed with it, but we did have ministers that most of them were from, you know, missionaries that they grew up in other countries. But they would come and they would perform exorcisms, you know, by the tradition of laying on of hands.
Yeah.
And I was very much inspired and touched by some of the manifestations that I experienced in that system. And I knew that beyond anything else, if nothing else was true or accurate or even real, that what I was experiencing when I would walk behind these men, when they would lay hands on the afflicted, it was very much real. It wasn't mm-hmm. a figment of my imagination. It wasn't a subconscious projection of a belief system that I didn't even have. You understand, it transcended that microcosm. And so I took what I experienced in that belief system, and I went to a more secular field of research. And I said, okay, but what do other religions teach on this? You understand? And I mm-hmm. that's really what led me into it. And then I just started reading academic papers, just tons, all the literature, you know, Summers, Sinistrari, all of them.
Yeah.
Most of them, if anything I get my hand on. But that's really what led me into the field. And it's really been a blessing because this is, I mean, obviously we're dealing with malevolent hauntings and entities that are otherworldly. But beyond that, it's a very fascinating subject.
So let's get on then to your research.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I suppose the field of demonology today, your own approach, because I'm looking at the notes here and it says you are a founder of the preternatural phenomenal philosophy.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
You know, let's look at that and also the sort of breadth of what is demonology, because I mean, people's definitions of what demons are mm-hmm. vary. Are they, you know, relics of early man, sort mm-hmm. of the Assyrians often get mentioned in this, and particularly, what's his name, the Mesopotamian deity, Pazuzu. Mm-hmm. And then others say, well, really, it's not really a thing or a demon, it's just sort of malicious ghosts. Where are we in the field? I say, I'm a novice in this area, so for the benefit of myself and our listeners, take us through where we are in demonology at the moment in the different schools of thought.
Okay. Now, first and foremost, there are two schools of thought in the discipline of demonology. There is what is called systematic demonology. Primarily, those demonologists come from the Catholic seminaries, most of them. And systematic demonology is someone who can take a whiteboard and a dry erase marker and list the different deities, their names, their roles, their modus operandi, and in a very short amount of time, create a spiritual hierarchy with the intent of saying that there are some demons that are in charge of others. There are some mm-hmm. demons that are more powerful than others. Now,
that's very much like some of the stuff that came out of France in the 19th century, isn't it? And all the sort of lists of all the demons of hell and that kind of thing.
Of course. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's called systematic demonology. And I am not a systematic demonologist. I am myself, my humble position on this is that I'm not a proponent of systematic demonology. And I'll tell you why. There's a famous linguist that said, when you want to define a word, don't look at its meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So with that said, I'm going to go right to the meaning, as ironic yeah. as that is. The term demon, especially in biblical antiquity, the concept of the horns and hooves in demonology was foreign and alien to Hebrew thought and First Temple Judaism, which is the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we do have are migratory loan words that are employed both in Psalms 91, Psalms 109 and 6, and a plethora of other texts, but they're migratory loan words. What that means is that in Hebrew thought, that they would experience something malevolent that they had no frame of reference for. And so instead of going to the Hebrew language, which they did not have at that time a word for the demon, they would mm-hmm. simply go to Mesopotamia, to the Akkadians, and say, listen, what do you guys have? What's the best thing do you guys have that we can transpose to what it is we're experiencing? So in the Old Testament, that was the word shadim, which is mm-hmm. the Akkadian word seidu. And then moving on to the New Testament, the Second Temple period, the evolution of their thought concerning demonology began to transition. It went from idols or other god, lesser gods.
Mm-hmm.
It went from that to the two disincarnate spirits,
mm-hmm.
specifically evil men and women who, for whatever reason, had something in their crawl and would displace other people's consciousness through possession.
Right.
Now, yeah, so beyond that, then you have Hellenism coming into the first century. And Hellenism with the Greek gods, and but that's essentially where I began my research. And the two schools of thought are either these are actual demigods, or they are disincarnate spirits. And as a primer for demonology, I'm a part of the latter. I'm a part of the disincarnate spirit theory.
Right, I've got you. Yes, that makes a lot of sense. You mention. Apologies if I don't pronounce it correctly, the Dybbuk.
Yes, sir.
Which I looked up before the conversation, before the interview, and that is defined here as a malicious possessing spirit believed to be the dislocated soul of a dead person.
Yes, sir. The Dybbuk, yes, sir. The Dybbuk, see, what I try to do in my work is I really want to separate these motifs from pop culture, because I think that pop culture, especially for people who are actually genuine in this field, it really muddies up the waters. And the first of all, the Dybbuk is not about a wine box. That comes from a play. It's not the actual research of the Dybbuk.
Yes.
I have to tell people that. Some people do not know that. Most people do, but there are some that do not. But
yes.
The Dybbuk is the modern demon in Judaism.
Right.
And the Dybbuk narrative began when their exorcists in the first century saw possession not as an idol possessing the heart, nor of horns and hooves. That's my favorite phrase. Horns and hooves possessing someone. They did not see that at all. What they saw in a malevolent possession was afterlife phenomena.
Right.
And that began in the first century with an exorcist called Eleazar ben Simon, who the historian Josephus wrote about. And that was when you really saw the legend of the Dybbuk come to the fore, was when Josephus penned the words, to me, these were not devils, they were in fact humans. And that has changed my life in terms of what I believe we're experiencing both in possession and in malevolent hauntings.
Right. These malevolent possessions. Mm-hmm. Are these, if you like, the disincarnate souls of dead people, or could they even be projected by living people?
I would say this. There are cases where possession would seem to be the case, but in fact, there are illnesses involved. However, there seems to be a niche in my field of researchers, painfully, who they do not come from the tradition of theology, but they're more scientific based. And I understand that.
Yeah.
But what I do not want to do is blame the victim.
Mm-hmm.
And not that we're doing that at all, and that's not what I'm saying, but there is a narrative being drawn where if we cannot explain it in any other term, it has to be, you understand, oh my God, it has to be this part of the reason. It is, you know, it's not true. There are cases actually where people are possessed and it doesn't really begin or end with a subconscious projection. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. a bit like the theory about poltergeists, that
yes, sir.
It's very often blamed on the person playing pranks or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's one way of interpreting it. I have no problem with that up until we blame the victim. Mm-hmm. I cannot fathom being in some of the cases that I've been in and having a housewife literally shake the table in fear of what she's experiencing. Mm. And then me look at her and say, listen, it's all your fault.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's almost damaging.
What part does death play in the origin of these demons then?
Well, this death places a pause. This is what the research, the data sample tells us. That when studying the language preferences, the belief systems, and values of these possessing entities, what we can for sure say is that when they die, the belief system that they had, the worldview that they possessed at the moment of death, it transcends time and it follows them into this, at least this portion of the afterlife.
Right.
Now, the first exorcists to experience this and really document it accurately and intelligibly was, who was it? It was not Sinistrari. No, it was Isaac Luria. These are tons of guys right out here. Isaac Luria and Jaime Vital. This is in the 16th century, which in academia they call it the age of the demoniac. Mm-hmm. And what the most fascinating thing about what they did, they accomplished a tremendous feat for this discipline. They said that when they would go and exorcise these quote-unquote demons or dibuk, that primarily the entities that they would encounter, and this is a very touchy subject, but I have to go here, they have either committed suicide,
mm-hmm.
they were either murdered, or their life was cut off untimely.
Right.
So
yes.
They begin to compile their experiences. Their sample data was magnanimous enough for them to accurately depict what we're dealing with. And it was far less horns and hooves, slithering forked tongues, cursing and hissing at the priest. It was far more, and they even have cases of, I need to contact my husband and tell him I love him.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful piece to the puzzle. Or it was simply someone who is suffering a very spiritual form of PTSD who is actually reliving the trauma of his last moment of life. And then they would have – and based upon – I guess I should say this. Based upon what they were experiencing, that's how they approached it.
Some of that really sounds similar to theories about what ghosts are, don't they? You know, the residual ghost is, you know, imprinted on the area where some traumatic event happened, you know, where they died or killed or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
There's also a belief that you can have ghosts that you can interact with as opposed to just blithely going on. And I mean, it's also very similar to a lot of the messages you hear about in spiritualism. It's people who've passed over mm-hmm. wanting to clear up matters with their loved ones they've left behind?
Of course. It's very much an archaeological feat. Very much so. It's not just anthropological or even psychological, but when you're going into homes that are haunted, you are dealing with an archaeological site at which at any point you can trigger something. And then you're in the middle of an excavation where you have to determine why this entity's here. Most importantly, if it's a familial spirit that's lived in the house, what are its boundaries? And that's one of the – I won't get into that right now, but it's a very fascinating subject. But you're exactly right. And that's the same thing Luria and Vital said, because they had some of their traditions still. They were very literate people who knew that there were some people in the Levant who believed that these entities were devils. But these devils had memory, they had belief systems, and they didn't believe in some things and believed in others. And if I could pause right now and give a huge piece to the puzzle that really added to me, to everyone, is this. If demons are fallen angels, then they should be fallen angels according to one or all monotheistic religions. That should be the assumption. Is that correct? Yes.
Yes.
So the problem is, it's not true. It's not just not true. Both in the context of teachings and theology, because in Judaism you have the Dibuk, Christianity you have demons, and then in Islam you have the jinn. None of those three are alike. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the most alarming revelations in my work, was when I thought, you know what, if I threw a rabbi, a pastor, and an imam in one room and said, settle for me what a demon is, within 5 minutes, all three of them would come out, shaking their heads, smiting the air, saying, I'm right, they're wrong. Mm-hmm. So either we're interpreting the data wrong, or we're not creating enough of it to interpret accurately. So we have to expand the data sample.
Yes.
And that's when I got into epiphenomenal philosophy, specifically preternatural.
Take us through on that then.
Okay.
Because, just going back to the point you're making, obviously, other religions have demons or something equivalent of them, but they have long since vanished. The cultures have vanished. The languages they spoke have gone. I'm thinking of all the peoples of the Mesopotamia early times. Does that mean, if each one has its own demons, they suggest there's a lot of redundant demons sort of sitting around somewhere saying, nobody believes us anymore. So, your idea about the priest, the rabbi, and the imam all having different views and different perspectives. It's not just those three, it's plenty of other religions as well that the similar issue. Yeah.
Of course. Mm. And it was very grievous for me, because I'm sitting here and I'm thinking in my mind, there's no way I would disrespect it, but I wouldn't even discredit what they're saying. Mm. I would simply saying that to define an experience based upon your description of your experience, it's, and this is no pun intended, but it's hauntingly troubling for me, because, and this is what I'm saying about preternatural epiphenomenal philosophy, phenomenon is something that happens. It's an occurrence.
Yeah.
Epiphenomenon is when something happens after something happens. It's a secondary consequence, or it happens alongside of it. And the problem with demonology is that for centuries we have encountered something with a capital S as something. And we could not define it. And so what we would do is we would, instead of defining it itself, we would define whatever we felt. So especially in Pentecostalism, we didn't have spirits. We had spirits of something. Mm-hmm. Right? So, and then it would always become, well, I felt fear. Well, then what kind of spirit was it? Oh, well, that's the spirit of fear. No, it's not. So that's what they began to do, especially in biblical antiquity, was I feel A, B, and C. Therefore, this entity that I'm experiencing must, number one, want me to feel A, B, or C.
Uh-huh.
Right? Or number two, it is the feeling and what I feel in A, B, and C. Now, to put this into correct perspective, I liken it to this. If a man steps into a pool of water, that's phenomena.
Yeah.
That's the act. There is an agent present. But because his presence is there, his weight and mass displaces the water. Right? And
right,
so you're
yes.
looking at the waves. There's a wake in the water. That is epiphenomena. That is not the presence. This is good. That is not the presence of the man, but that happens because of the presence of the man. Does it make sense?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So even in parapsychology, because religion wasn't alone in this matter, even in parapsychology, we're standing in different parts of the pool measuring the wake, defining the wake. And for 3,000 years, every religion, that's what I'm saying, I don't want to discredit them. I will simply say we're interpreting the data wrong. And that's – it's sad to say, but now it's like Voltaire said, some truths are not for all time or for all men.
Yes.
So we're finally beginning to rehash these ideas and respectfully say, you know what, guys? It may not be that you didn't experience something real. We do believe you experienced – it may be that we have misinterpreted what we have experienced. Because yes. we're standing in the corners of the pool counting waves and not realizing that there's a whole nother field of research right in front of us that if we paid more attention to, instead of the waves, it's the what. Instead of the waves, it's the why. It's the who.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I have hung my hat as far as this is the direction I want to go with this.
You're listening to the Weird Tales Radio Show with Charles Christian.
What practical applications have you been able to enjoy or experience with your different perspective?
Well, my different perspective, in theory, it began years ago, but in practice, it happened about a year ago when I finally got enough proof in my mind to begin to implement some of the practices of my heroes in the field. Number one, I was at a restaurant and I was eating my food and I get a private message on Facebook. And I've had other cases, but nothing to this degree. And it was a lady, and she said, listen, she said, my sister-in-law was brutally murdered in her home. And she said, my brother was also stabbed, and he's in critical condition. And she said, he was in critical condition. He's out of surgery, and he's at the house now. And she said, but we're experiencing a lot of paranormal activity. And she said, I would like you to come and to pray, because my father's a pastor.
Right. Yes.
This is interesting. So she thought she was talking to my father. And my father knows what I do. And so he was like, well, he's like, I'll go and pray. He goes, but you know, that particular area is not my field. So, but as she's messaging me, it was the strangest thing. I was sitting there eating my food and messaging back, but all of a sudden, it was like I left. It's the only way I could explain it. I was sitting down, but I was also walking up stairs of a two-story home, and I was walking into a room, and I was staring at a closet. And I told this woman that. I said, okay. I said, for some reason, I'm walking up steps, and I'm being led to a closet. Well, she starts to freak out. She says, well, she goes, I was led to that same closet last night. And like I said, this was all in theory until it's practice. And that's when it really gets crazy, right? I mean, it's like, this used to make sense. I used to believe this, but how does it really apply? So I get there, and then within 5 minutes, I have it on recorded, and I didn't know which rooms are whose. I really had no idea, first of all, where the murder happened, how the murder, who was murdered. I had no frame of reference. But all I knew was that there was a man upstairs in a closet. So we went up there, and I remember telling her I said, there's something in this closet. And I said, whoever this entity is, like I said, not whatever, not horns and hoofs. I mean, if a demon is a demon, you know it's going to be killed, like, or not be killed, but you know it will want to murder. But that's what I knew I wasn't dealing with. So I thought, man, what if I approached this like Lurio did and like Vital? And this gets wild. So I go in there and I say, you know what, whatever this entity is, whoever he is, it's attracted to this closet. So I walk back out and I say, okay, you know what, there's a second closet here. And I said, whoever this is, is also attracted to this closet. I go downstairs, I see a table, but I don't see a table alone. I see a table and a chair, but the chair is missing. And I said, the victim was sitting in a chair, she was smoking. And I said, I see her here, but I said, I don't see the chair. So I go in and I sit down, and I have it all on my recorder. So I'm sitting there and I begin to talk to them about just some of the history of the house. And the man says, well, he goes, my father-in-law, he says he was an alcoholic and he was a drug addict and he hated my wife. And he said he would beat her unconscious. And he said, and so what would happen is whenever he would get really drunk, really, you know, just hammered, the only way that his wife would be able to get him out of such a fit of rage was to calm him down, put him in a car like a kid, and take him to a store, a toy store, and get him green model trains. When he said that, the woman that called me out there, the sister, began to cry. She just began to look at me because we both knew exactly what had just happened. And she said, okay. She said, now, where did you put those trains? He said, well, after he died, we put them upstairs in a milk cart, in a milk crate, in a closet. He said, those are his. I said, okay. And then the lady goes, okay, well, what about the other closet with the bat, with the fishing poles and buckets? He said, oh, yeah, when he died, he was a big bass fisherman. We took his bass fishing tools and everything and paraphernalia. We put it in that closet as well. And then he goes, it's kind of funny that you mentioned that table out in the kitchen. He said, because you're right, there was a chair there. And you want to know who made that chair and that table? I said, who? He said, he did. I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah.
The lady who experienced this, even she wrote a testimonial on my Facebook page. It's legit. It's legitimate. And at this point, I'm starting to go, oh my God, this is real. Like, not in theory, but this is real. Like, okay, you know what I mean? Everything began to fit. And then he began to tell me about the person who committed the murder and how that when he first saw this person, it was a female, but there was a male's voice coming out of this individual during the murder. And so I said, okay, that's possession. What, you know, so at the end of the day, that entity was crossed over. There has been no paranormal activity since. In fact, the person who committed the murder has said, I don't even remember it. There was something that took a hold of me. And they said, I cannot believe what happened. Well, we know what happened, at least in the field of demonology.
Yes.
So again, not horns and hooves. This was a very real disincarnate individual.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it goes from theory to practice, that's when the research really becomes invaluable.
Are then possessions, for want of a better phrase, what traditionally would be called a demonic possession, are they the same as malevolent ghosts then? Or?
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
They are.
Right. Absolutely. And there's more than one way we can prove this. And I will say this. There's a lot of people in my field who approach demonic possession and the rite of exorcism through purely a Catholic view.
Yes. They've all seen the movie.
Of course. Right. Of course. And that's how I really know. Okay. Have you read the literature yet? Not to discredit it, but I will say Catholicism did not create the exorcistic rite.
Yes.
It existed thousands of years prior. Mm-hmm. And so they do not have a monopoly on what an exorcism is or even what a demon is. And so the reason I say that is because many people will try to convince us researchers and even people who aren't in the field but are interested in it, they will do their best to convince us that every possession entails a demon of systematic demonology. It'll have mm-hmm. a name like Leviathan
yep.
or Beelzebub. And so yep. there was one school of thought that said, well, maybe it's, you know, demons impersonating dead people. And I said, yeah. no, maybe it's dead people impersonating demons.
Yes.
The reason I suggest that is because it's quite obvious when you have demons who have language preference. Demons yeah. who prior to the, oh Lord, prior to Mariolatry coming to the fore in history, demons were not fearful of Mary.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that.
Yeah.
Why? Because Mariology was a part of the evolution of human thought. People who lived and died only have the frame of reference they had.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until people lived and died with the knowledge of Mariology that all of a sudden you have demons afraid of Mother Mary. Or, I mean, it's so that what I'm saying essentially is that these entities are displaying memory.
Yes.
And yes, they can transverse the many languages, or at least four or five, but nevertheless, their theology is their theology. You'll have demons, and we do it. In Baghdad in 1999, we had a case of exorcism where a rabbi could not get a spirit out of a person. He employed uh-huh. everything he could according to Judaism.
Hmm.
But Semitic thought, just the generalization, Semitic thought was there. So he went to an imam and said, listen, I can't do anything with them. What can you do? The imam pulled out the hadith. And that entity, here's what's interesting, guys. It goes back to what I said. It has to be a uniformist. If they're not all uniform in their belief systems, their faith and their fear, then our demonology crumbles. Does that make sense?
Yep, yep.
And so he employed the hadith. Turns out that that particular entity had far more fear and faith in the hadith than it did in the Torah. As yes. though it doesn't mean that one's better than the other. It just means that, listen, our approach is fallible, and that entity was removed by what it believed in.
That's always been one of the things that struck me about exorcisms, particularly the Catholic form, where traditionally said in Latin, well, what if the demon doesn't know Latin? It's not going to have any effect on them.
Of course.
What if the demon is, you know, as I say, Babylonian or from some other entirely different area? So, yes, no, that makes a lot of sense what you're saying. Yeah.
And not only are, okay, not only do some of these entities have belief systems, not only do they have language preferences, and even that sometimes they'll display certain amount of memory, never about the future, it turns yeah. out, you know, but always about the past. Not only that, but there was a great researcher. His name's Father Sinistrari of Amino, and he was a Franciscan priest, and he was one of the very first researchers that was humble enough and intellectually honest enough to say that there are at least a portion of these entities who are pagan.
Yes.
Now imagine that. This is what really gets in my skin, gets under my skin. How do you have a pagan demon if the demon itself is defined by a religion? There's a disconnect here, and the disconnect is not small. It is huge. It's magnificent, and I believe that it's time for my field, my discipline, if we're going to light the torch, to eliminate the darkness, we have to be honest with this data.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that with my whole heart here, humbly. We have too many cases where people are dealing with entities and entities that they have no frame of reference for, they have no defense mechanism against. And we have religious zealots who, instead of saying, listen, I'm not saying my religion's wrong, maybe my demonology isn't as evolved as I'd like it to be, then the whole field would change and we could really add more value.
Another question. Mm-hmm. What is the inherited self?
Ooh, very good question. Awesome. The inherited self, as best as we can tell, the inherited self is and was what theology would teach us hell is, I should say.
Right.
So the inherited self is, it goes back to the Dibbuk. The earliest pictorial tradition of the Dibbuk is a man, obviously Middle Eastern. He's got a staff, he's got a robe and sandals, but there's a skeleton that is literally blanketing him. It's conforming to his flesh. Now, in Semitic thought, that is an inheritance. So if you go into the Old Testament, there's a word for possession. It's called rasha. It's also, has a dual meaning. It's rasha, meaning possession and evil. And it was always employed as an inheritance. When Yahweh tells Joshua, go and possess the land, it was rasha. And in the following verse, it says, and that will be your inheritance. So it's Psalms 109 and 6. I'm going to answer your question because I have to give a preface to it. Psalms 109 and 6, David even asks Yahweh to place a rasha man over an enemy of his. What do you mean? He's saying, and this is not Nathaniel Gillis. This is your exorcist in Jewish antiquity who say this, that David was essentially saying, God, put over my enemy a possessing evil man. What is that? That's a Dibbuk. Put over him. Like wear him as a piece of clothing. So that's the inheritance that you did not deserve. Oh, this is interesting.
Yeah. Right.
So that's what I'm saying. So the self-inherited existence, the inherited self, is when you die, but you do not inherit someone else's evil nature. No. The man that you were in life will be the man that you inherit in the afterlife. So every failure, and I'm talking specifically about evil men.
Yeah.
Every murder, every scar you carved into the consciousness of others, every heartbreak that you did with impunity, whatever you were, you will die and you will become 10 times that. And you'll be haunted by the fact that you can't change it.
Right. Yes.
And so the inherited self and an attachment, they're the same thing, but they're different in origin. So like I dealt with a young woman who had an attachment of suicide, and she came to me and she said, it was interesting. She said, my best friend's grandfather was chased out of his home by a demon. He had a heart attack outside. You know, you might need to come to the house and expel it or cleanse it or whatever it is that you do. And as she's talking to me, I said, well, I would love to do that. I said, but there is a cloud. The only way I can explain it was laying on top of her back. Like it was right over her. There's a dark cloud over you. I said, there's an attachment of suicide. And I said, and I do believe that your friend is going through something. I do believe that you came here because you thought your friend needed help. And I said, but here's what needs to happen. I began to list some emotions that she'd been dealing with. And I said, these are not your own. I said, now who in your family committed suicide? She said, my grandfather did. See the parallel here. It's so fascinating. She said, my grandfather did. She began to cry. And she held her arm out, put my hand over her wrist, and I felt the indentation of someone who tried to commit suicide by slitting her wrists. That's the attachment, but that's not right. The inheritance itself. That man inherited himself, but that young woman had an attachment, and that's the difference.
What do you mean by symbolism being used in hauntings?
Oh, man. Good question, sir. This is, oh, I love this. This is so fascinating. So symbolism being the simplification of language. Symbolism being it's not mutilation, it's scarification, because there's not just symbolism in hauntings, there's symbolism being employed in possessions on the skin. This is this is so broad. But what happens when I go into houses, and even in the chronicled cases of history, there from time to time there will be symbols that are either carved on the skin of individuals in the home or on particular religious relics, on walls, you name it, it's happened.
Yeah.
At first blush, when I began my research in that area, I thought that, number one, it was propaganda. I thought that, man, you know, like, what if that what if you see a statue of Mother Mary and the entity has burned her thumbs? What if that was just to scare people and to tell us that, you know, they don't believe in Mother Mary? I thought that makes sense. But then the deeper I got into it and began to read more about anthropology and what symbolism meant, symbolism cannot – first of all, I'm going to say this. I did not – I went from thinking that it was an accident to if it's propaganda and on purpose to none of that at all. What I began to think is this, that they're marking their territory.
Right.
Oh, this just gets deep and dark. Number one. Number two, the symbols that they're using are not alien to us. Again, there are at least some of these entities who are not just disincarnate, but they are operating off of memory, specifically memory of the occult.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, symbolism being used, simplification of language, it's the iceberg. This is what you see, but there's so much more going beyond. Outside of it. So let me say this. Mariolatry has two definitions, two different modus operandi and ways of accomplishing. Number one, you have the worship of Mother Mary, the deification, ancestral worship of Mother Mary. Number two, after that came to fore, you have the occult defacing Mother Mary in their rituals. That's also called Mariolatry. So what happens when we go into a house and we see Mother Mary defaced? Sure, we can say, wait a minute, that's the propagandist. Or we could say, no, there is an entity here that is performing ritualistic rituals, I should say, and that it's actually doing something in this house. It's not just here possessing and haunting. There's a purpose for these symbols. So we've seen that in the 666, right? Mm-hmm. You have people with their foreheads being caught. I mean, 666 on their skin. And in the intimate parts, especially in the deep boot cases, and the incubus cases, where after the relations have been had and sometimes consensual, sometimes not, I will say that, that entity will mark its victims.
Mm-hmm.
So in haunting cases, we have symbolism. Everywhere, and some scarification. But if you go into Sinistrari's work, and even Montague Summers, we also have symbolism being employed through the act of scarification on the bodies. It's the same thing, but it might be different. See, okay, Fritz Kramer is an anthropologist, German anthropologist, and I'm not rambling. I promise this is right where we're okay. Speaking of symbolism and scarification, Fritz Kramer and Sinistrari said the following. The scarification on the bodies of these victims can either be accidental or they can be designed. One of the things that was quite alarming to Father Sinistrari was that the scarification that he experienced in his cases He would literally have doctors that he would call from all across the country. He would set them down in one room. They would do an investigation, I guess, a physical investigation on the bodies of these victims. They would find scarification in the private areas and underneath the eyelids.
Mm-hmm.
So symbolism and scarification are exactly the same. They're just carved into different places.
Now, I'm conscious we're using up a lot of your time, but a couple more questions. What is this thing, the darkness? How do we fight it?
The darkness can be summed up in understanding the difference between presence and absence. We're not looking at a void here, and I say that allegorically. We're dealing with a presence that is very much like us, but it's not the absence of us. I should say that it's anti-presence.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is it's not just darkness. It's darkness with a motive. It's a darkness with a belief system. What we can do, the only way to fight this, is to take everything that we've learned up till now about demonology, put it to the side, and redefine some of these terms, and really dig down deep into our own lives in terms of what is it that I believe in? What is it that they believe in? What are they after? What do they want? I know we're running out of time here, but I will say this. The banishment of a being in the rite of exorcism was the last resort.
Yeah.
Never the first one.
Yeah.
And so in order to fight the darkness, we have to have communication. We have to dialogue with it. Mm-hmm. And we'll find out very quickly that it's not as dark as we think it is. That there are sure malevolent entities out there that would do anything to hurt, kill, and maim. However, there is information available to us, if we're looking for it, that will allow us to do more damage to the darkness than it does to us.
For people wanting to know more about, I suppose you'd call it, the discipline of demonology, what would their next steps be?
Well, I would go into biblical antiquity. I would go in, even though they're going to deal with descriptions, it's good to know what the first descriptions of these entities were. I would read the literature of your exorcists in the New Testament. Read Josephus, read about Yochanan ben Zakkai, all of them, Hillel, all of these guys. I would read those. I'd read Montague Summers, Sinistrari, Fritz Kramer. I'm trying to list out all these authors, man. I've got so many, but that's what I would do. I would not start out with Horns and Hooves. I would not go to prove, oh my God, are these demons of, are they fallen angels? It will mess you up. For 10 years later, you'll come to the conclusion, I just wasted a decade. Because that's number one. But number two, do not be limited by your data sample. Expand it. Go into Haiti. Go into the African rituals and ancestral worship. Those are the two biggest things. Beyond that, do not ask the same questions everyone else has. Because a lot of people have asked the wrong questions thinking they have the right answers. And because of that, I think that it's really hampered our field. And that would be it.
Mm-hmm. And just one final question. I see you've got a book out, last year, A Moment Called Man. Mm-hmm. Is that related to demonology or is that something totally?
No, sir. It's an homage to my religious tradition. It's not theological. I'm not teaching doctrine and whatsoever, but I am giving practical life stories. I had lost a friend prior to me writing that to addiction.
Right.
And I had to write that book just for people who, not that they're addicted or anything, but people who are in the fight of their lives. But it has nothing to do with demonology. I am writing my first book on demonology as we speak, and it should be out in May or June, and I'm excited about it. I'm very much excited.
Right. May and June this year.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. Well, that was brilliant, Nathaniel. Anything else you'd like to add or you feel we've missed out in the interview?
Well, it goes back to the questions. We have to ask the right questions to get the right answers. And the questions that we've been given by antiquity are not monolithic. Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, for some reason, their demonologies, at least in Christianity and Judaism, their demonologies have stopped growing. It stopped. And in Christianity, when I would deal with pastors who would ask me questions and maybe had different ideas about what I was doing, I'm just like, you know, let me ask you this, you know. And I said, it's like this. It's like asking someone, let's say you ask history what a demon is, and then you stop them mid-sentence to whatever made sense to you most. And you said, that's it. I don't want to know anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what we've done. And it's evolved since then. So, but other than that, I'm thankful that you had me, sir. It's been a humble and it's been an absolute honor. You got me speechless here, brother. And I am so happy to be heard in Britain. And one of my good friends, Daraw Mason Field, he's a photographer. He's there. He's a hero of mine. And I'm just humbled to be here. And I thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, I think that's the perfect note to end on. So, Nathaniel Gillis, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
And that's it. We're totally out of time. Just remains for me to say, this is Charles Christian saying thank you very much for listening in, and I'll hope you'll join me again same time next week when we are going cryptid hunting. Till then, stay well, stay weird, stay different. Good night.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon. Which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. You can keep in touch with us online at www.weirdtalesradio.com, by email to weirdtales@icloud.com, and on Twitter at Christian Uncut. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Good night.